Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we get to talk with award-winning health journalist Dr. Robert Davis about his book, Coffee is Good for You. We'll finally solve the debate.
A declarative statement, maybe.
Maybe.
And we'll get to talk about a lot of other research that he does on nutrition. Looking forward to that conversation, Christy. But first, we actually have some research that matters on our own. It actually isn't our research, but the ones that are happening around the world this week, one dealing with revisiting questions about statins.
Another about pregnant women getting STD tests.
Or sexually transmitted diseases, nothing that anyone wants. And another one about pain. And are there ways of lowering it naturally?
And another one about acupuncture, potentially helping people with COPD, or that chronic lung disease we talk about a lot on the show.
Well, let's literally dive into this first article that was a commentary really in the New England Journal of Medicine that also looked at this meta-analysis of trials about statins, those cholesterol-lowering drugs, for which really great evidence exists that they really do save lives as it relates to preventing heart disease. But now the question comes up, do they raise the risk of developing diabetes? And if they do, what do we do with that?
So this one study that they looked at was the Jupiter study, which was about almost 18,000 participants who did not have diabetes that had certain cholesterol levels and certain CRP or C-reactive protein levels. So they were the same in the group, and they divided them into people who got statins versus placebo.
And there was a higher risk of developing diabetes if you had taken these statins. But they did also find, like other studies, that there was a lower rate of heart disease. And certainly the lower rate of heart disease is much more likely to prolong your life than just an elevated risk of the diabetes. On the other hand, an elevated risk of diabetes, I think, is a cause for concern for some people.
Yeah, I think so too. But I think we definitely have to underscore that the people on the statins had lower risk for heart attack, lower risk for stroke, lower risk for better vascularization of their heart, and a 20% for death from any cause. So, I mean, they are beneficial for preventing these heart problems. But for a person who maybe has borderline cholesterol and is concerned about developing diabetes, it's certainly a conversation to have with your doctor about whether or not it's right for you.
Right. They had this what's called that number needed to be treated. So if we treated 250 people for 4 years, we would prevent a little over 5 heart events among those people who took those statins, one of whom might develop diabetes. So that scale, to me, tips pretty strongly in terms of taking these statins. But also maybe let's talk about exercise and proper nutrition, particularly.
Real lifestyle change.
That's right. So we can prevent potentially that diabetes from forming. Okay. Very good. What's our next research that matters, Christy?
The next one is about pregnant women getting recommended STD or sexually transmitted disease tests, in particular looking at chlamydia and gonorrhea, which are recommended for women who are pregnant in the ages of 16 to 24 or other women who are at higher risk for developing these infections.
And this research that was published in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology showed that only a little over 50% of the women who were coming in for routine prenatal care were getting this recommendation for testing for chlamydia, which should have been much higher. Certainly, we would expect it to have been over 80%. And so the question is, why weren't these women getting tested? And is that a problem for which we should be intervening or recommending interventions?
Well, I mean, it's important to uncover these infections in women who are pregnant because it can lead to problems with the pregnancy if people are more likely to have miscarriages or inflammatory disease of their pelvis. But also eye infections, pneumonia, other problems in newborn babies that can come from chlamydia in particular. And so knowing, and it's a treatable, these are treatable problems. So being able to diagnose them and treat them is important.
What we don't know, though, Christy, is that the women who didn't get treated, how many of them actually would have had it or had, you know, we don't know that.
And who didn't get tested, right?
Who didn't get tested. So it may be that there is some self-selection going on here. But I also worry that maybe people don't know that they have it or don't know that they have risk for it.
Well, and now that there are easier ways to test for it through urine tests as well as the swabs, I think that hopefully will improve people's ability to get these tests done. And
maybe we need to change the terms. Instead of calling it STD testing, which sounds kind of like, oh, you are you've done something wrong or you're expecting. No, let's call it newborn healthy testing, newborn and mother's healthy testing, healthy babies testing or something. And you know, that we want to make sure that you don't have anything that you can give to your baby. Without, we probably can't do that, but I think that would help get people to do it more.
It. Sure, sure. And, you know, the truth is these guidelines have been in flux. And during the time that they studied this, they were still in flux. So I bet the rates are a little bit higher now.
We shouldn't be quite as alarmed, but we should encourage it.
Exactly.
I like that, moderation. Let's talk about our very next in terms of moderating pain and a research that matters that was in a journal called Current Biology.
So, I mean, I guess my first question is for you, Adam. Do you think that chewing gum, thinking happy thoughts, taking deep breaths, like general wellness and meditation, those types of things can help with pain?
Absolutely, sunshine.
I believe it. I'm over here smiling and taking big breaths.
Well, and even laughing. I mean, we know that laughter has this wonderful modulating effect in, about one's thoughts. But if we didn't think that one's thoughts and one's actions result in pain, I mean, how does pain come about in the first place in some respects?
Yeah, it's hard for us to understand. But this was a study that suggests there may be some truth to this. They looked at high-resolution spinal MRIs, like functional MRIs, where you can see what happens in the signals of the spine during pain.
And what they discovered was those who were doing these type of distracting actions actually had different areas of their brain light up, suggesting that there was these were real improvements that were occurring. So they reported less pain, and then when they tried to block those things from happening, those what they call androgenous opioids, those natural pain relieving things, when they gave a drug that blocked them, they found that those actions didn't happen, didn't give as much pain relief.
Well, and also when they did the either a hard or an easy memory task, the ones who did the harder of the two memory tasks were more distracted, perceived less pain, and also had lower activity in the spinal cord on these MRI scans.
Right.
So suggesting there really is a connection there. I'm looking forward to learning more about it.
And the great thing about this, Christy, is there's no side effects.
Right.
You know, taking a few deep breaths, really thinking about things that make you happy, and maybe chewing the fresh gum versus staying on that one piece of gum for an hour or two.
Well, it relates back to that conversation we had a while back about positive psychology and links to health. So,
well, let's talk about our very last research that matters, talking about positive things. And this was a study of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in the journal Archives of Internal Medicine.
Okay, this was a study from Japan, a small study, 68 patients. But the thing I liked about it is to study acupuncture is tough. People know if they're getting a needle put into them. But they did it with either real or fake acupuncture, meaning that both groups got the little needles. Just some of them were in the proper lines of acupuncture, and some of them were in just sort of random places on the body.
And in the real acupuncture group, they actually had significant improvements in shortness of breath and significant improvements in their exercise capacity compared to those who got the sham acupuncture. As a matter of fact, results were as strong as what we might see in some of the trials of medications or pulmonary rehab with exercise.
I mean, this to me was very impressive difference between the two groups. And it's a small study. They had weekly treatments for 12 weeks. I know there are issues with cost and insurance coverage and those types of things that could be barriers, but it really has a lot less side effects than most medicines that we prescribe to people. So
right.
I think
this
it has potential.
It's potential. It's probably safe. And for some patients, this may be an alternative, something worth exploring.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
okay.
Christy, that really concludes our research that matters. But in addition to this acupuncture, we've talked about very simple ways to help pain relief, things like happy thoughts and taking deep breaths.
We've talked about pregnant women and getting their wellness and newborn wellness tests or STD tests.
And then finally, about balancing out the risk versus the benefits of statins, but the scale is really definitely tipped still on those benefit side.
So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, Adam and I will talk with Dr. Robert Davis about his book, Coffee is Good for You. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with health journalist and author Dr. Robert Davis about his new book, Coffee is Good for You. This is really timely, Dr. Davis. Welcome to Your Health.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Well, Adam and I have had many a conversation about coffee and about different research related to nutrition. And so we are excited to share your book and to have this conversation today. But let's jump in and tell us, how did you get interested in health journalism, nutrition research, and what's the story that led you to write this book?
Well, you know, I have been a health reporter for many years, and the subject that gets the most attention out of everything I report on is nutrition. Stories about food and health always get a lot of interest from readers and viewers, and a lot of friends and family ask. And so after I wrote my first book called The Healthy Skeptic, I got so many questions about, you know, is it true Cheerios really help your cholesterol? Is it true that red wine is good for you? I decided to look at a lot of the claims we often hear and to try to look at the science in an objective way. Not the spins and agendas, but to look at the science and really help readers understand what's true and what's not if you take a strict look at the evidence. And that's what I did, and I focused on a number of subjects, including coffee.
Well, I know we're gonna dive in, and we're going to spend some time definitely talking about coffee. There was a recent New England Journal of Medicine article about coffee that has driven a lot of interest. But Christy and I have talked about this a lot. But before we do, let me just ask you one more other question, which is that it seems that the interest in the science of nutrition continues to grow, but it also seems that like many things in science, when we get more research, it also seems to cause more confusion about what is good and what is bad. How as a journalist have you been able to deal with this kind of simultaneous, the need for more research, but also seems like more confusion?
Right, absolutely, and that's something that I address in the book because, as I say in the book and as I tell folks when they ask about this, the problem is that the way that these studies are often reported is in isolation. We hear about one study at a time. And the way that you really can draw any inferences from this is to look at all the studies, what scientists call the totality of the evidence, and to put all the studies together, all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together, as it were, and to try. And if you do that, then in many cases, you can make more definitive conclusions about what is probably good for us and what's probably not. But the way that, unfortunately, the way we're exposed to this is by one study at a time, and that's often very confusing because individual studies are going to reach different conclusions in many cases.
And so take us through the process of how you evaluated the evidence on the various nutrition topics that you cover in the book. Were these mostly through systematic reviews, or what was your process?
What I did was to gather all the major studies, and by that I meant studies, and I outline in my book how I look at studies. I use what's called an evidence pyramid, and at the top of the pyramid are the most definitive kinds of studies, so-called randomized trials, and then at the bottom are test tube studies, and in between I list different other kinds of studies such as case control studies and cohort studies, and briefly explain what these are and explain that different kinds of studies can yield different levels of evidence. And so what I did was to look at the studies, look at particularly the studies from that top of the pyramid, randomized trials and cohort studies. Those are the large studies that follow people over sometimes decades and sometimes hundreds of thousands of people. And I tried to, as I say, take these pieces and see if the pieces as a group were pointing in the same direction. putting a particular emphasis on those studies at the top of the pyramid. And then often there are reviews, so-called meta-analyses and other kinds of reviews of studies, and I put particular emphasis on those in terms of guiding what's believable and what's not.
Well, I know Christy and I really bring to our listeners this systematic reviews, these meta-analyses, these compilation of data. And one of the – let's just jump right in with one of the ones that obviously is right at the top of your list, because your title of your book is Coffee is Bad, Crossed Out is Good for You. And their recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine covered extensively around the world about coffee. Help us understand what did this recent study show? What was different about that study? And then how do you as a health writer – begin to interpret that study in view of the other studies?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say I chose that title because coffee, if you think about it, the ultimate example of things we've heard it's bad for us, we've heard that it's good for us, and I chose that because most people drink coffee and they're confused. And so with regard to this individual study, this is a large study. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is a prestigious medical journal, involved more than 400,000 people who were followed over a period of about 14 years. So that's a fairly large, extensive study. And the researchers found that those who reported drinking coffee up to 6 or more cups a day, which is a lot of coffee, had a lower risk of dying during the course of the study than those who drank coffee rarely or never. And so the way that this was reported, and if you saw it in newspapers or heard about it on the radio or on TV, often reported, it's confirmed coffee is good for you, this proves it. Well, the truth is it's an observational study, and like all observational studies, it cannot prove cause and effect. So no study is definitive, particularly an observational study. We can't say that we're sure from this that if you go drink coffee, you'll live longer. That's not the correct interpretation. But the correct interpretation, as I see it, is that this is one of a number of studies now, and the evidence has been mounting from a number of different studies that look at all kinds of outcomes, not only death, as was the outcome here, but also heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, Parkinson's disease, a number of different conditions. And as a whole, the studies done in different populations measuring different things point to a possible beneficial effect of coffee. One thing I think that is reasonable to say is that if people are concerned, if they drink a few cups a day or are concerned that it's causing them harm, the evidence points in the direction that it probably is not for most people. I think that, in terms of a take-home message, is one we can get from looking all of these studies as a whole. As for whether it's beneficial, I'd say maybe, and the studies certainly suggest it could be, but again, most of these are observational studies, and so we can't say that for sure.
Well, and a lot of the studies, I know the one on diabetes and there's some on memory, a lot of them look at people who are drinking pretty large quantities of coffee in a day. It looks like this recent one was just 2 or more cups of coffee a day. But, I mean, the other question is, you know, if there is a cause and effect and how much coffee would lead to that. It poses a lot more questions than it answers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and certainly we know that for certain people, you start drinking more than a few cups a day, you start having some negative effects from the caffeine, perhaps. And so
Sure. That
has to be weighed as well.
Well, Adam and I often laugh about every study that comes out on coffee I want to review on the show because it justifies my existence of drinking so much coffee. I will keep drinking it.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Robert Davis, award-winning health writer, also teaches at Emory University Rollins School of Public Health, about his new book, you know, Coffee is Good for You. And Dr. Davis, I guess one question is, you know, we certainly see these associations, but the next jump would be a real trial where people would be kind of broken into two groups. One group would get their coffee and the other group would not. And you would almost like randomly. Do you think that type of trial is likely to happen in this particular field? Because I could see that the people who probably do drink coffee are different than the people who maybe don't drink coffee. And so can you really get the type of gold standard trial that you need?
That's a great question. And the short answer, I would say, is no. When it comes to many of these questions surrounding diet, it's really impossible for several reasons to do this kind of gold standard trial you're talking about. Because you think about what you'd have to do. You'd have to lock people up essentially in closed environments and control exactly what they eat and drink. And you can't just do this over a short period. If you're trying to see whether they develop heart disease or cancer or whether they die, you have to do this for many, many years. And so not only is it practically impossible, but even if you could do it, the cost would be exorbitant. So,
well, and who would pay for it?
You know, right, and who would pay for
it?
So I think there are all kinds of issues. So I think when people say, well, we can't believe any of this because these are observational trials, my response is, you're right, it doesn't show cause and effect, but it's the best evidence we're going to get, and we have to piece that together with other observational trials. So we have to look at all the observational trials and then piece that together with other kinds of research, such as lab research, that shows that perhaps, at least in theory, there may be some beneficial effects, and to put all that together. And I think that that's the way that we have to interpret nutrition research, because unfortunately, we often cannot do these kinds of randomized trials.
Well, you do a great job of breaking this down into plain language in your book, and I'm looking forward to hearing more. We do need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Robert Davis, about his book, Coffee is Good for You. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with health journalist Dr. Robert Davis about his book, Coffee is Good for You, where he really goes through an evidence-based approach to try to summarize the evidence on various nutritional elements that we hear about, whether things are good or bad. You know, I wonder, Dr. Davis, in doing your research and preparing for this book, what was the most surprising evidence finding or myth that you had in your head that you debunked by looking at the real evidence?
Well, there were several. One is water. People all the time, you see people everywhere carrying water bottles.
Right? We don't need water?
Right. We don't need water, right. But people hear that everybody needs 8 glasses of water a day, and you hear see everybody trying to get enough water because they hear that you're going to be dehydrated. And what was interesting there is I looked at the evidence, and I couldn't find any. Surprisingly, it's one of those ideas that just keeps getting repeated. But if you try to trace it back to where this comes from, there's never really been any kind of definitive study or studies to show that this is the case. And
right.
So it's a good example of how medical ideas can get propagated without really very little or any grounding in sort of science. And
well,
this is a good example of that.
I hate to keep bringing up the funding, but then who would pay for it? I mean, the Earth, who's going to pay for a study on water?
No, and that's a terrific point. And a lot of these, I focus on this in terms of, follow the money. Where does the money come from? And either when you hear something good for you, or when there's a lack of research, and that's a key factor. And so, in this case, though, I think this is an example where people who are forcing themselves to drink water all the time. Now there are a few exceptions, which I list in the book. For most healthy people that are forcing themselves to drink water, that probably is not necessary, and they can drink when they're thirsty and focus on maintaining their health in other ways.
Well, let's just follow this water analogy. We're going to if you give a mouse a cookie, they're going to want a glass of milk. So, water. What about bottled water? Because it seems to us that clearly, Christy and I each have our bottled water right in front of us here. Keep our lips nice and moist. But if you gave us a choice between a cup of water from the tap versus the bottled water, what do we know?
Well, what we know is that for most communities, the bottled water is no better for you, no safer than the tap water. That most communities, the tap water is perfectly safe. There have been studies that have shown that it's in some ways better because it has fluoride, which is something that's important in terms of your health of your teeth. And so in many cases, bottled water just comes from the tap in Peoria or somewhere else. They've taken it and filtered and done some things to it maybe to make it taste better, but taste is a separate issue. So if you prefer bottled water because of the taste, that's fine. But if you're drinking because you think it's safer or purer, in most cases, that's not necessarily
the
case.
You mean my bottled water is not coming from a mountain-fed brook stream with trout that are downstream from it?
Despite the pictures on the bottle and the implications, that's generally not the case.
It's pure life is what it tells me.
It comes from the tap in
Wichita. Well, what other surprising findings did you have? There's so much to cover. I want you to drive what you found that people have been most surprised by.
Well, you know, another thing is farmers markets. And again, I'm not here to bash farmers markets. I think I'm all for them. I think folks should go and support local farmers. But I think there's this perception that's grown up that you somehow, if you get your produce at farmers markets, it's going to be more nutritious than the produce that you get elsewhere, say at the grocery store. And there are two problems with this. Is that number one, people assume it's organic, and that's not necessarily the case. And we can talk separately about organic as to whether it's even proven to be more healthful than conventional produce. But number one is the produce isn't necessarily organic. And number two, people assume, well, because it's right off the farm that it's more nutritious. And again, this is something I found that was surprising. In some cases, things that, for example, blueberries, if they're stored a little bit longer, they have slightly higher nutrient levels than blueberries that are right off the bush. When I say nutrients, I mean antioxidants, for example. So that's not to say that going to the supermarket, it's going to be better for your health to get the blueberries there. But my point is that you don't necessarily have to go to the farmer's market to get produce that's going to be good for you. Any kind of fruits and vegetables are good, and if you don't have access to one, if you go to the grocery store, if you find for whatever reason that's a better option for you, that's fine. Just eat your fruits and vegetables.
Well, I know you're going to get probably 1,000 letters, I think, from farmers locally. May not all be the ones that are just encouraging, but you mentioned organic. And so there, I think, a growing perception and belief that organic produce is more healthful than produce that is sprayed with pesticides.
And for full disclosure, Adam buys organic and I do not. So
full disclosure, I rarely buy my own food. But as it may, I am vegetarian. And so we're going to have – so first we'll go to the organic, then we'll go to the vegetarian. But because I think in your book you talk about that the evidence is kind of inconclusive about whether organic is healthy or not. So
right.
Meaning that it may – we just may not have enough evidence.
That's right. And so what we do know is that pesticides in larger quantities, for example, when farm workers are exposed to pesticides, that's harmful. There's no question there. But the issue is whether the trace amounts that we get on our food is harmful. And there's some preliminary studies, especially in children, suggesting, and again, it's preliminary, maybe some effects to the brain and neurotoxic effects. But no one can say for sure. And
not
so
good.
It really gets down to the question
scary.
Of, do you want to sort of hedge your bets and be better safe than sorry? Scientists call this the precautionary principle. But on the other hand, we know that these can be much more expensive, this organic produce. And so my view, what I do, is to sort of go somewhere in between. So I will pay more for the kinds of produce that I know have more pesticides on them, for example, strawberries and apples and grapes, and things like bananas or onions that tend to have fewer levels of pesticides than conventional, I tend to go with the conventional. So there's actually the Environmental Working Group, I list this in my book, has a great site. You can go and look up the levels of pesticides if you want to be selective about which fruits and vegetables you pay for. One thing I want to add quickly, and that is, though, one area where I think that's clear to me is that a lot of junk foods are marketed as organic. So you see cookies and crackers and chips that have the organic label slapped on them. You need to be careful about that because there's been this attempt to use the word organic in marketing to make any food that is otherwise junk be sort of seen as healthy just because it's got organic on it, and people need to be aware of that marketing trick.
Well, speaking of marketing, it is confusing for consumers just because there's so much selective use of science for people who are looking to sell a product. You mentioned Cheerios and cholesterol, but you include at the end of your book some 10 tips for deciphering diet and nutrition claims, and I wonder if you might share a few of those with our listeners of really the best way to sort out truth.
Sure. Well, one thing I say along the lines of what you just mentioned is ignore the claims on the package. The thing to look at is that nutrition facts label. That's the important part. But anytime it says boosts immunity or helps, you know, improve cholesterol or whatever wording they use, just keep in mind that there are unfortunately loopholes in the law that allow companies to use sneaky language that imply that they're having health benefits and they can get away with it illegally. But in fact, they don't have to prove it. So my view is that all of these things that are on the packages outside of that nutrition facts label are best ignored because you're exactly right. Food companies use all kinds of marketing tricks to make you think that their foods are having all these health benefits when in fact that may not be the case. So that's one thing that's important.
So what are some of the tips then that you would recommend to our listeners?
In terms of the looking at the food?
To really decipher, as you describe, these claims that are being made.
Yeah, well, I think, in terms of the other things that I list in the book, I think that another thing you have to keep in mind is that often you have celebrities endorsing foods and endorsing kinds of diets as well. And I think that's another point that often these get promoted throughout the internet, and people are told to follow a certain eating pattern or certain diets or certain foods because of celebrities. And this, unfortunately, carries great weight with a lot of folks. And I think we have to remember that we shouldn't expect nutritionists to entertain us. We shouldn't expect celebrities to give us nutrition advice. And I think that's an important point that often is lost in the way that these things are promoted. So I think that's something that's really important.
And I think you also said that you seem like you're fairly skeptical about vitamins.
Yeah, I would just say that, unfortunately, it would be nice if we could take the benefits of food and put them into pills. But despite the hullabaloo over a number of vitamins, whether it's vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin B, that you hear all these great things they do, and then these randomized trials, these definitive studies we've talked about, the kinds of gold standard studies that are done, have shown time after time after time these vitamin pills don't live up to their billing. So I think it's not to say they have no place at all, but I think to look to vitamin pills to keep us healthy, there's not a lot of evidence that they do.
So Dr. Davis, what's the easiest way for our listeners to get a hold of your book? Is it Amazon or Google it, or do you have a website?
Yes, the website is coffeeisgoodforyoubook.com, coffeeisgoodforyoubook.com, and you can find out more about the book and how to get it. It's available in bookstores. As well as through online retailers such as Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can buy it online or in bookstores, or go to my website and find out other ways to get it.
And there's also a picture of an orange on your book, and I'm looking here, and it's high in dietary fiber, has 0% fat, 0% cholesterol. I take it this orange is really good for you. I hope so.
I certainly hope so, because I eat plenty of them.
Well, we really appreciate. We've been talking with Dr. Robert Davis, award-winning author and author of the new book, Coffee is Good for You. Thank you so much for writing a book which is good for our listeners to read and consider how they may implement some of this for their own lives.
Well, thank you. And again, thanks for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Davis. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have any question from today's show or your own health question, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we're going to answer some questions about cat bites and what else?
About bullous pemphigoid. It's hard to say.
It is, and not a good thing to have, but we'll talk about it. And someone who recently actually had a chlamydia infection, we talked a little about this on Research That Matters earlier.
And also about a skin lesion.
Well, let's listen to our very first House Call about a cat bite.
My cat bit me on the hand recently. It was my fault, really, because I scared her. She's had her rabies shots, and the wound looks okay, but I have 5 bite marks all over my hand, and there's bruising. Do I need any shots? Do I need any antibiotics?
Aw, sweet kitty.
I don't like the kitties all the time.
Well, and in this case, it sounds like you feel bad. You feel bad about it, or thinking that it's your fault. And to some degree, you know, I'm sure the cat didn't mean to harm you, but to have a bite on your hand from a cat does actually matter. That does require some treatment.
And we're certainly glad that your cat has had their shots. But whenever one has bite marks or scratch marks on the skin, particularly on the hands, with cats and oftentimes dogs, those bites can sometimes go a lot deeper than you appreciate, and we really worry about infections.
And cat bites in particular, as well as human bites, usually do get infected. So we usually do put people on antibiotics. And if it's been more than 5 years or so since your tetanus shot, then that's something we'd also usually do in the office. So I'd go get it checked out.
Yeah, we'd probably recommend that you be on antibiotics for this one and not wait to see if you really get an infection. So good luck, and next time, let's approach that cat very quietly.
Okay, let's take our very next House Call question.
My father has a disease called bullous pemphigoid. It's frustrating because it does not seem like his doctor can cure it. It gets better, but it keeps coming back. Do you have any ideas?
bullous pemphigoid. Well, let's talk about what that those terms really mean. Those bullous are kind of bubbles filled with fluid, small bubbles filled with fluid, and pemphigoid is a disease that where the body kind of attacks itself. And so you're having the body attacks itself, and it creates these bubbles filled with fluid that can pop up on the skin and on the extremities. And it can be a chronic problem when we don't really know what causes it.
That's true. And it is a persistent skin condition. So the treatments are made to help the skin heal or to avoid itching and try to kind of knock it back. But it's not something that we can just cure and make it so that it never comes back again.
What some of the treatments that doctors who will treat this, and it can be done by really any doctor who knows and has treated this, would be steroid agents. A lot of times the topical steroids, if the bullous pemphigoid is not so large, work really well, and then you don't have to take those systemic or those steroids called prednisone.
Which can make you feel really kind of wild.
Yeah, but that also can work, and if it's bad enough, that really should be done. But again, we're talking about trying to control the disease, and you may really need to work with a specialist here because sometimes you might need to be on steroid-sparing agents or some agents that other than steroids. It's a difficult disease.
There are several different medicines that are in the category of anti-inflammatory medications or even immunosuppressants that suppress your immune system so that it doesn't fight as hard against your skin. But we wish you all the best and hope that you work together with your doctor in a way that sort of keeps this thing at bay so you don't have to deal with it so much.
Get it early. Good luck. Let's listen to our very next house call.
My doctor recently told me that I have chlamydia and that it must have come from my partner. How do I tell him and also ask him about being with someone else? We have known each other for many years, but only recently had intercourse.
Well, Christy, this is one of those questions I'm going to ask your opinion on because this is hard. This
is
not
so
an easy
hard.
Question. And I would, we empathize because this is no fun.
Yeah, I mean, I have this situation, unfortunately more common than not in the office. And I really encourage my patients to be honest. Like it's really important for you to sit down with your partner and be fully honest about what the diagnosis is and that, your thoughts that it must have come from him and a conversation because he needs to be treated too. And you have to have that trust and open dialogue to move forward.
And it's not like he would have knowingly given you this infection. I mean, it's possible, but it's also possible that he may not have known that he had an infection here. So that there's a lot of uncertainty here, and that's the uncertainty, creates an issue. And if you've known each other for many years, there's a friendship there too that's at stake here. And so any other tips you might have, Christy? Because I think this is one that I'm not sure we have all the answers.
No, we certainly don't. I mean, this has a lot to do with your relationship and the strength of that relationship. But honesty and full disclosure are really what it requires.
And this is treatable.
Yeah,
this is treatable.
It is treatable.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your question. Let's listen to our very last house call today.
I had a pre-cancer lesion on my scalp, frozen by my family doctor. It came back twice after freezing. Should I be worried that it's cancer or something else? What should I do?
Well, it sounds like to me that these may have been what we call AKs or actinic keratoses, or at least the doctor thought that when they froze the little skin lesions off. And usually you freeze them and they go away. But the fact that they keep coming back is sort of a tip. That
little red flag.
Yeah.
Should you be worried? Yeah. A little bit. Yes, absolutely. Enough to go get it biopsied? Absolutely.
And sometimes those AKs are pre-cancer, but they could also be a squamous cell or other type of skin cancer. It tends to just grow right there, that particular type of cancer, but can kind of invade into your face or other places. So it's important to get it removed.
Yeah, and freezing won't allow that biopsy specimen to go to the pathologist, and that's what you want. Well, thank you so much for your questions today, and we really want to thank everyone for all of their questions. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you, and you can write to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Get our health app on your phone by searching for Your Health, one word, for a download.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Robert Davis.
We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.